those first early rounds of chemo, we'd be lying on our daybed having this poison pumped into us that we very much hope was doing us good. And then this trolley would come around, pushed by volunteers who were the nicest people. But this trolley was full of fizzy drinks, chocolate bars, crisps, you know, and you were all encouraged, you know, get it, have a chocolate bar, have a... It just seemed to me really shocking.
Well, you probably don't need me to tell you that that's the voice of Sheila Dillon, esteemed food journalist and BBC broadcaster, notably of Radio 4's The Food Programme. And she wants food to feature much more heavily in our conversations about cancer. This is the Liz Earle Wellbeing Show, the podcast helping us all have a better second half. I'm Liz Earle, and as you probably know by now, I am on a mission to find ways for us all to thrive in later life by investing in our health and our well-being today. And with cancer predicted to affect at least half of us listening right here, the food being something that nourishes all of us seems a very fitting discussion for us to be having. Well, Sheila has been a food journalist for more than 3 decades. She was an editor at Food Monitor magazine in New York and then came to BBC Radio 4's The Food Programme, first as a reporter, then producer, and now presenter. She also helped set up the prestigious BBC Food and Farming Awards, of which I've had the honour of participating in. Well, she's robustly researched and scrutinised everything from the dodgy science behind, quote, healthy margarine, a personal bugbear of mine, which I write about actually in my new book, A Better Second Half, to the growth of the organic food movement, another personal fave, which we'll touch on. But it's her professional and personal lives colliding that I really want to focus on today. In 2011, Sheila was diagnosed with a cancer of the bone marrow, which informed a new line of research for her. Is there a connection between what we eat and cancer risk? In fact, listener Jenny recently wrote on Instagram at Liz Earle Wellbeing that it would, quote, be a good chat to have dietary help about post-cancer. Well, Jenny, I really hope that you find this particular conversation useful.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Sheila, welcome. I am so looking forward to this conversation, and I'm just really grateful that you have found time to join us. So welcome here.
Delighted to talk to you, Liz. I mean, we spoke, as you said, when you came to the awards, when you were involved. And
yes.
And yeah, it was interesting.
Well, you know, you're from a farming background, so let's kind of rewind the clock a little bit. What kind of a farm was it, and how did you eat growing up?
I am. My one set of grandparents were farmers, but they were in Northern Ireland. So I didn't grow up on a farm, but I grew up in a small village where, you know, we were all involved in farms. My sister and I were sent down to one of the farms in the valley during our summer holidays to, you know, when we were little, to be cared for by the farmer. And as soon as I was 13 and it was legal, I started work on the farm almost across the road from where we lived, working in the dairy and collecting eggs. And so farms, you know, were a big part of my childhood, a big part of life in Horton in Lancashire.
I mean, growing up in that environment, did you grow up drinking whole milk, raw milk maybe, eating red meat? I mean, was it that sort of, you know, straightforward traditional
very
background?
Straightforward. I mean, nobody talked about raw milk. I mean, it was just milk.
It was just milk,
It was just milk, which came from, you know, one of those farms, the farms where my sister and I used to go in the summer holidays. You know, there was still some veg growing in the village. Most of the vegetables that we shopped for came from the Fylde, you know, that big rich area of rich land out toward the coast from Preston. So that's what we bought at
sort of
Preston
local
Market.
And seasonal.
Yeah, because it was before supermarkets really got going, and Boots, which is now a, you know, a high quality supermarket chain in the Northwest, you know, was just one shop in Preston, one big shop. And, you know, my parents and grandparents, we were, you know, we're working class. This is not middle class poshness, but my grandma, you know, always got her bacon from Booths. And, you know, there were just different shops for different things. I mean, and, you know, my grandma was a housewife. My mother worked full time, however. We ate really well. I say that I didn't eat bad food till I went to university. And I think that's almost entirely true.
Yeah. Well, you've been working on the food programme, as I mentioned, for decades as a producer, as a host now, you know.
Yeah, a long time, yeah.
You know, what is it then about these conversations that's kept you hooked for so long?
It's partly, I didn't really engage with this until something happened to me when I lived in New York when I was being a journalist. But I could easily see how central food is to it, to health, to us getting along as people, you know, learning to deal with other people, sitting around a table. You know, something happened to me in New York that sort of focused that childhood, you know, I suppose I was a greedy child. I love food. I mean, both my grandmother and my mother were really good cooks. I mean, not in a romantic way, and they didn't go on about it. They barely ever mentioned it, but they were.
Yes.
And suddenly this New York, when I was feeding my toddler son and I read about this pesticide incident, as it was called in the New York Times, on Long Island, when this pesticide, Aldicarb, or Temic, to use its commercial name, that was planted with the potatoes, had leached into the aquifer under Long Island. This is the center of Long Island. Everybody knows about the coast where, you know, rich people have their summer houses. But in the middle, it was commercial potato growing. And this pesticide got into the water, and whatever the US Department of Environment is called, had closed the wells that took water from this aquifer and were sending tank loads of water into these communities.
Good heavens.
Because it was considered unsafe. And I thought, well, if it's in the water, you know, how much is in the potatoes, which I had been feeding to my child?
Exactly.
And I thought, you know, I was so naive, and I really thought there was, you know, a really sound safety system around food. And when I went down to the library, Times Square, to try and do some research on pesticides, I saw how extremely unrigorous the whole thing was.
Yes.
Highly influenced by the manufacturers of pesticides. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about a time after, you know, Reagan, when there was this revolving door policy between the manufacturers of pesticides and the regulators.
I think there still
is. Oh, absolutely. It's got worse. But yes. And so it was so shocking. I thought, who's writing about this? Who's broadcasting about this? You know, I'm going to do it, because I've been writing for the glossy magazines about feminism and women's health and that stuff. But here was this shocking thing. And in a way, it was my experience as a child of eating well, of working on farms, of understanding how food was produced, that I was able to focus on this new, you know, this, okay, I'm going to do this professionally.
Isn't that interesting how these things happen from an incident and something that you're authentically involved with? And we'll come to your cancer diagnosis in a moment, but your sister actually got breast cancer and chose not to go through treatment. You know, she had surgery and she made lifestyle changes. What was her outlook, and how did you feel about that at the time?
Well, I have to say that I was pretty shocked by her decision. My sister is she's retired now, but she was an occupational therapist and she worked in some big hospitals in Northern California. And anyway, she got this cancer diagnosis and it was small cell cancer. It wasn't a tumor. It was diffused through the whole breast. And she had seen, you know, professionally, she'd seen a lot of patients undergoing cancer treatment. Mm. And she decided, she had a meeting, I remember at the time, with several oncologists at this teaching hospital. And they reviewed her case. And they said that unless she had chemotherapy and radiation as well as surgery, you know, she had no chance. She was going to die. And everybody agreed, apart from one young male oncologist who said, well, what are the statistics on her survival if she does do all this stuff? And they were not good. So she came out of this and thought, I'm not doing it.
Really?
I'll have the surgery, but mm-hmm. I'm not doing any of those things. And she got in touch with a cancer nutritionist, you mm-hmm. know, that somebody who'd, you know, a properly qualified mm. person, and that were quite, I don't think they existed in Britain at the time.
Right, yeah.
Before anyway, Bristol. That's what she said she was doing. Yeah, and that's what she did.
And she obviously recovered because she's still with us.
Yeah, 25, 28 years later, she's fine. She's never had a recurrence.
And did you think she was crazy? Did you think she was
I thought, hurt? Yeah. I was frightened and sure. my parents were frightened. And I mean, they were just frightened at the name, at the cancer, sure. You know, that terrified them. But she was determined and she did it.
So moving on, you were diagnosed with multiple myeloma in 2011.
I was, yeah.
Can you explain firstly what type of cancer that is? I'm not familiar with it.
It's a relatively rare cancer. It's a cancer of the bone marrow. It screws up the, you know, the formation of pretty vital cells in your blood. There are different varieties of it. I've got the light chain one. And, you know, it didn't look good when I was diagnosed because at that point I had 3 crushed vertebrae. You know, it had really attacked my bones.
Wow.
The life expectancy, vaguely, the oncologist told my husband, I didn't ask because I thought, you know, that's not the kind of thing I want to know. Mm. It's about 5 or 6 years.
Well, this story obviously has a happy ending. And
well, not quite ending. It's not quite
well,
ending.
Well, not ending, but no. Okay, so happy ongoing, shall we say.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And by the time you were diagnosed, you'd made 3 editions of the food program about cancer and diet.
I had,
so
actually,
so did the
yeah.
conversations, you know, that you'd had there in your professional life, did that affect how you approached your diagnosis in your personal life?
Oh, it did, yes. Because the very first one, it came, there was a report, the World Institute of Cancer Research, I think it's called, based in London. They came out with this research which showed that countries with diets higher in vegetables and fish and what we now know are low in ultra-processed foods had much lower rates of cancer. And it wasn't a genetic thing because, you know, low cancer rates in Japan, Japanese people move to the US, their cancer rates become more or less of the society they've moved to. So it had, you know, there was a very strong indication that it had to do with their diets. So that, you know, what that wasn't world-shaking. We sort of knew, you know, there had been epidemiological figures before that. But as I was reading this, I thought, I wonder what effect those diets would have on the recurrence of cancer. Would, if you move to a diet like that, would it help you in recovering and in keeping recurrence at bay? So, you know, I was producing the food program then, so I could make these decisions. I thought,
great.
that's a good program.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We, as part of that, we rang round the main cancer research hospitals in the UK and tried to find people to talk to about this and talk to cancer researchers. And we were dismissed as, I mean, we didn't get one positive response.
Really?
You know, like it was an idiotic question. I mean, what of
That's
course
outrageous.
Not. You know, don't be, well, how stupid. And I thought, no, it's not an idiotic question. It may not, I mean, the answer may be no, it doesn't make any difference, but it's not an idiotic question.
No.
You you know, early on at the food program, when I'd come back to Britain from New York, I'd heard about the Soil Association, you know, the organic body. I'd heard about that in New York from this wonderful, you know, I'd been to a conference with this wonderful woman, Joan Gussow.
Oh, yes.
I'd heard about Lady Eve Balfour. And of course, I got a copy of her book, The Living Soil. And, you know, I mean, that's, it's there. There is evidence.
It's all there. Yeah, yeah.
It's all there that, you know, when, if you eat healthy soil, living soils, plants that are, you know, have less water, have more concentrated nutrients, and animals eat those plants, and they are, you know, soil, plant, animal. It's a chain. It's ridiculous to think there is no connection between what we are made of and the diseases that we suffer from. And of course, there's pollution, and, you know, there's plastic pollution, and there's, you know, there's all kinds of things that might stop your natural immunity to, you know, cancers develop all the time, we're told, and you know, your body fights them off, but there may be reasons. You know, I live in London, a highly polluted place. I don't know why I got multiple myeloma.
No, and, you know, obviously strong genetic component and all sorts of things, as you say, environmental. Yeah. What was the medical profession telling you about your cancer diagnosis? You know, did dietary advice come up at any stage along the way?
Well, it was interesting. I'm married to an investigative journalist, international finance, but he likes to bring those qualities to bear on when faced with any difficulty.
Mm.
So he did a lot of research about who I should see in London when, you know, the diagnosis was extremely delayed by the GP not taking this, any of this seriously. You know, you're over 60, you know, what do you expect, kind of thing. Anyway, everybody that he talked to in Australia and in the United States and here said, you have to see this man called Jamie Cavanaugh. And he turned out to be head of hemo-oncology at Boris Hospital. So that's where I got referred. But he's a very open-minded person. He doesn't know much about food. But, you know, he thinks, you know, the world is a, you know, more complex than you might think it is. And I had read about this research on curcumin, the active part of turmeric. And oddly, he had another patient who had reached the end of the road in terms of conventional chemo, etc. And she had used this same research I'd read to take 8 grams of curcumin a day and had recovered. You know, she went back to being completely well. And what Jamie Cavanaugh said is, what can I say? You know, she'd said to him, if I do this, will you monitor me? Mm-hmm. And he said, yeah, of course. And when he wrote about it in the BMJ in patient's notes, he said, you know, there is no other explanation for her recovery than
turmeric.
But he said, it's one case. You know, this needs much more research.
Yes.
Has it been researched? No, of course it hasn't been researched, because it's, you know, you couldn't patent.
No, you can't make any money from it, basically.
You can't make any money from it. Yeah. And there we go to the heart of our problematic medical system.
Absolutely right.
Because drugs are only going to be developed. I mean, you know, and I'm grateful. I've had chemo drugs and I'm very grateful to them. But, you know, there's this other area that really needs research. But who's going to do it?
So was that a key food ingredient for you then, curcumin? Did you start taking very high doses daily?
I start taking it almost within weeks of starting my first chemo. Treatment.
So you took it alongside. So you had your conventional and your unconventional.
Yeah.
And how long did you take it for?
Oh, I took it on. Well, I still take some of it. I don't take as much now, but I took it for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years.
Really?
That much.
Really?
You know, and it's, you know, you need to take the kind that's got black pepper, you know, piperine, the extract of black pepper, so that your body can use it. So, but I don't, you know, and I don't, you know, what can I say? Yes. I mean, I know what happened to his other patient. You know, she and I met eventually.
Yes.
But, you know, I can't document it. I mean, I am one of the very few people. I was in a trial at the very beginning of my conventional treatment for multiple myeloma. And I think I'm the only one, or one of a very small group, who's reached this stage, you know, got this far and not had a stem cell transplant.
Gosh.
You know, I may still need a stem cell transplant at some point, but I haven't had one in 13 years.
That is really an extraordinary story. And what about mushrooms? Because I've been researching medicinal mushrooms and know that in Japan, for example, turkey tail seems to be, you know, almost the standard perceived medical treatment for things like some forms of stomach cancer. Did medicinal mushrooms feature at all, or do they still feature at all for you?
Yes, they did. I mean, you know, I have seen a Chinese doctor, and I got mushrooms from him. And then early on in after my diagnosis, my husband read, she says, looking at my bookshelves, you know, this the book that my husband read was called Anti-Cancer, A New Way of Life by Dr. David Servan-Schreiber, who'd had brain tumor. Anyway, it was a doctor's, a scientist's assessment of what indications of, you know, research. There's a whole chapter on mushrooms talking about the use of mushrooms in Japanese cancer treatment.
Fascinating.
You know, the way that some mushrooms are used alongside radiation to mitigate the effects of the radiation. Anyway, it's a bit out of date now, but it's still absolutely... Mm. You know, key guide, I think, and really opened my eyes. I mean, I couldn't face reading that at the time because I was too angry, upset, everything. But Peter read it and took notes, and I changed, you know, my diet changed in accordance with his recommendations, you know, including mushrooms, but including much more, you know, cruciform vegetables, you know, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, watercress,
watercress.
And the onion family.
Well, listen, let's take a moment's break here, because when we come back, I do want to dig into the role of so many of these fascinating natural medicinals, if you like, particularly looking at some of those families, the cruciferous families, you say, watercress, the alliums, the onions, etc. And also, I think we should talk about how we can tackle the amount of ultra-processed foods that we're putting into our bodies and what role that might play.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So, Sheila, you talked about the brassica family. So that's things like the cabbage and Brussels sprouts and broccoli. Was that a particular focus as well, following on your diagnosis?
It was, yes. Unfortunately, I love all those vegetables.
Yeah,
so it was no great difficulty adding more.
Yeah.
But it was just an awareness. Also, I discovered that there was a cider farmer, Oliver Dowding, in the West Country.
Oh, gosh. He's amazing.
Who was producing...
Yeah.
Yes. And he, at that time, you probably know about this, Liz, he was producing cold-pressed broccoli sprout juice.
Oh, Yes, extraordinary
and,
stuff.
So I started, I added that to my diet as well as buying and then growing my own broccoli sprouts.
Broccoli sprouts. Yeah, they are fascinating, actually. You've reminded me that I need to get sprouting. I have a packet of seeds in my cupboard looking at me every time I open the door. And I absolutely need to get on with it. And then the onion family. So things like onions, leeks, garlic, did they feature?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They added them in massive amounts to my diet. Yeah.
Really?
Again, not a hardship. I like them.
No.
And, you know, I can cook, so that's, you know, that's a plus. And
that
it
is
must
a benefit.
Be much harder.
Yeah, if you don't come from that background, you haven't grown up with the habit of
well,
cooking.
Well, if you haven't learned
scratch.
In school, I mean, I did domestic science in school.
I'm just about old enough to have done that too. So, yeah, back in the day. And then watercress, you know, watercress, again, fascinating. I did a bit of research recently on that, and I included it in my book, because watercress, and again, you have to have it raw, so rather than, you know, boiling it up in soup, has this extraordinary compound, doesn't it, that's been particularly linked to being protective against lung cancer specifically.
I mean, I've read it too. I mean, I read reports of that. I haven't done any, you know, deep research into it.
It seems solid. It seems pretty sound. Mm. And not that, you know, I think we can sit and smoke 20 a day and just eat watercress, but I think there is definitely something there that seems to have specific anti-tumor properties and just is so deserving of more research, isn't it? But of course, to your point earlier, that's just not happening.
Well, and what I felt back in 2011 and 2012 when I was setting out on this, I suppose definitely a journey, was that, you know, look, well, you know the kind of attacks you get for even mentioning complementary therapies, let alone alternative therapies like my sister's. But you get these attacks, you know, it's like, well, there's no gold standard, you know, research on this. Well, we know why there's no gold standard research on this, you know, with double blind studies, and A, it's difficult with food anyway. So what you have to do is be very intelligent and look at the animal studies, you know, the laboratory studies, the in vitro, and you know, you have to sort of use your brain and say, well, you know, if this happens, there's a good chance that it would in fact have this effect on a human being. I mean, we can't sit around and wait for these double blind studies in the kind of situation we find ourselves in.
Yeah, and hope that, you know, somebody might have a philanthropic angle and just want to fund them for the benefit of humanity.
Yeah,
I guess we do need to be careful though about, you know, suggesting that diet alone can affect cancer.
Oh, absolutely.
Because you know you say yourself that, you know, you had both together.
Absolutely,
and that definitely,
yeah,
I'm sure improved your chances for.
Well, I mean that's
treatment.
The point of the Servan Schreiber anti-cancer, a new way of life, is that it's about the combination. It's not saying give up.
I mean, talking about giving up, I'm wondering here how sugar intake fits into this conversation. I've read a book by the 1930s scientist, early oncologist at Warburg, really documenting how sugar feeds cancer cells. He was one of the first to really clinically show that, and then that research seemed to have been sort of shelved or has been buried over the years. What's your view here on the role of sugar, and is that something, you know, we've talked about the things that you added in, but did you consciously stop having sugar in your diet if you'd been having it before?
I became quite conscious about, I mean, I don't have a particularly sweet tooth, but I did try and cut it out almost entirely, except, you know, for a great treat after a meal or, you know, a dessert or something. I mean, what I've read about sugar seems to me, you know, to back up what you were just saying, that yes, cancer cells seem to thrive, you know, on a sugary diet. And I was very interested when, during the whole process of my diagnosis, you know, I took one of those radioactive pills and then I was scanned, and the pill is glucose and radiation and is irradiated so that it then spotlights the bits in your body where the cancers are, where the, you know, and I thought, ooh, that's interesting, isn't it? That, you know, that they put it with sugar.
Because the cancer loves the sugar.
The cancer loves the sugar. Exactly. Ah. I thought, So I said this to one of the oncology team, and they went, oh, no, it's just, no, that doesn't, you know, it doesn't show anything. No. I thought, well,
of course it does. Yeah. That's extraordinary. Otherwise, why use sugar? You could have used, you know,
why
anything,
use sugar? Like, why not use, you know, broccoli juice? Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess it's interesting that we've talked here about you switching your diet and about people making changes as part of treatment. The other distinction, I guess, is in prevention and the role that diet can play in cancer prevention. I guess it's important to say that no single food probably can prevent cancer, but there are some things that we can be doing as part of an overall diet to reduce risk, for sure, wouldn't you say?
I definitely say for sure. I mean, look at the cancers that more and more people are getting. I mean, you must have seen a few weeks ago the new study showing that bowel cancer is now becoming very common in people under the age of 45. That used to be a cancer of old age. Well, why is that happening? You'd be insane to say that's nothing to do with what people are eating, when we now know quite a lot about the science of the microbiome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just going to ask about
that. The second brain in your gut, how that thrives or does not thrive, depending on what you eat. If you eat a diet very high in highly processed carbohydrates, sugar, ultra-processed food, you have a very diminished microbiome. You know, the effects of emulsifiers on your gut wall and, you know, leaky guts,
yes,
you know, it's
yes.
all there. And we now know, what is it? We have the second highest consumption of ultra-processed foods in the developed world. Only the United States has a higher level of consumption. You know, we're 50%+ of our intake being ultra-processed. Teenagers probably up there in the 80%.
Mm.
So what is the effect of of that on your immune system? Well, I mean, we know from microbiome research that a poor microbiome affects your immune system. It affects your brain function. It affects all kinds of things. You'd be, you know, why would you not take that seriously?
And I think interesting, looking at microbiome, I've written books on gut health, and it's, you know, it is one of my personal as well as professional passions.
Yeah.
And I think having, as an advocate for the Soil Association and the Sustainable Food Trust and the people, you know, PAN, people campaigning against pesticide use, one of the things that does concern me is, yes, it's important that people are eating plenty of fruit and vegetables, which is great, and your insoluble fiber and all of that, you know, supporting your beneficial gut bacteria. But unless it's organically grown, we're presumably ingesting ever-increasing amounts of pesticide. And by definition, a pesticide is getting rid of bacteria and bugs and pests, killing them. And that is killing certain parts of our microbiome, because our bacteria are ingesting the pesticide that is killing them off. And I don't know of any research that's ongoing looking at that. Have you come across anything in your research with the food program? Because I think that's a potential, I don't know, time bomb.
I think pesticide use is one of the great uninvestigated, quite scandalous parts of the food system. And we've been encouraged to dismiss it. Saying, you know, the safety testing is good, and, you know, you wouldn't be, you know, food wouldn't be allowed to be put on sale if it had, you know, too much pesticide and if it was dangerous. But in fact, you know, the facts are that pesticides are tested singly.
Exactly.
You know, if you want to put out a new pesticide, it is tested by itself on animals, usually rats. And that's not how we ingest pesticides. We ingest, you know, a cocktail of pesticides if we're not eating organic food all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And also, the testing of pesticides is short term. You know, they are looking at the effects on animals, you know, immediate effects. You know, do you get cancer? Do you get acute liver failure? You know, does the animal...
Straight
they're
away.
Not. It's not keeping the animal alive for a year or two to see if it, you know, gives, you know, whether you're more vulnerable to Parkinson's disease or whatever it is.
Mm.
There's, you know, it's completely inadequate, in my view, for safety. And I can't answer your question because I don't know the answer to that. But we all tend to take this view that, you know, okay, but, it, you know, if it's on sale in Sainsbury's or, you
it
know,
must be safe.
Waitrose or Lidl, it must be fine. You know, that's, you know, you're a bit like me before I read the New York Times report about the pesticides in the water in Long Island.
Yes.
You know, we
yes.
have this touching trust that it's all right.
I think maybe we should start to think about the positive sides of eating. We don't want to scare everybody away from their plates, because there is obviously this huge pleasure of eating and this sociability element to it. But I guess during cancer treatment, you're going to be challenged by that anyway, because cancer treatments can, you know, induce nausea, sore throat, trouble swallowing, changes in taste and smell. And that pleasurable experience, how people feel in themselves, is so vital as a part of our overall well-being. What was your experience of the joy of eating, or the loss of joy in this context?
Well, I think I was, you know, lucky with multiple myeloma, because, you know, it didn't affect my throat or my ability to swallow, or some things just tasted unpleasant. And I, you know, from the chemo drugs, really, more than the cancer. And I just, you know, gave up on them for a bit. And but a lot of things, I wanted things to be more spiced. I wanted more chili. I wanted more, you know, it seemed to deaden my my palate. But I, you know, it is really hard. And there is some good work being done about making food for cancer patients, you know, undergoing chemotherapy, making it, you know, better and tastier.
And is timing easier? I mean, is it easier to have sort of 5 or 6 small meals, for example, rather than, you know, 2 or 3 larger ones? Sort of the idea of eating little and often and just keeping yourself well nourished?
Yes, I guess that's, yes. I seem to remember enjoying dinner a great deal, but yes, I'm sure I snacked on good things, you know, olives and nuts and things.
Yeah, excellent. What about fasting? You know, did you do any fasting?
Well, I never did, you know. Right. Yeah, I mean, I have.
People do talk about that, don't they? You know, fasting for,
yeah,
for,
and
for
I,
cancer.
I wish, yes. I did go off to a health place at one point for 4 or 5 days fasting. And I, you know, it's one of those things I believe in theory. I'm not very good at doing it at home. I think it would be tremendously
yes.
good. Have you ever done it, Liz?
Yes, I did 2 long stints at booking a Willamy clinics in Germany and Spain. They're sort of like the grandfathers of fasting, 4th generation medicinal doctor family. And they have the largest fasting clinic globally. And they do have a lot of people there who have quite serious illnesses. And I think the longest fast I've done there was 12 days, and combined with daily enemas and colonics. I mean, you are super clean and super empty by the time you finish that program. But I felt absolutely amazing. And if ever I was seriously ill, I would definitely be hot-footing it back for a lengthy fast.
Yes, I mean, it's the problem is that kind of thing is not assessed or integrated into any worldview of, you know, one of the things, I mean, I've written about this, that when I was those first early rounds of chemo, we'd be lying on our daybed having this poison pumped into us that we very much hope was doing us good. And then this trolley would come around, pushed by volunteers who were the nicest people. But this trolley was full of fizzy drinks, chocolate bars, crisps.
Yes. Oh, hospital food. I mean, I'm sure you've spoken to Prue Leith on the subject. She's a great banner waver, isn't she, for that? I mean, it is shocking what is served in hospital.
Well, that's separate from the meals, which are, I mean, the meals are just unspeakable. I mean, inedible. But these trolleys, you know, and you were all encouraged, you know, have a chocolate bar, have a Lucozade,
feed your cancer cells with a bit more sugar.
Well, it just seemed to me really shocking. And you couldn't, you know, the people were doing it out of the very best intentions.
Of course.
And the other thing that was, you know, I was often nauseous at first from these chemicals. And the advice from the nursing team was to eat ginger biscuits. I mean, it was, again, most kindly meant, but ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, there's
yeah.
about, you know, 0.5% of ginger in a ginger biscuit, along with all the other things you don't want to be eating.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, the sensible thing was make some ginger tea. which helps enormously. But nobody, nobody at the hospital told me that.
Would serve ginger
tea. It was someone else, somebody. You know, I was introduced to someone in New York who'd had multiple myeloma. You know, because we're not that common. We're not thick on the ground, fortunately. And anyway, she said, drink ginger tea and squeeze some lemon juice into it, and you'll feel fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's absolutely right. But the hospital should have told me that.
Yes.
Should have told us all that.
Well, it is the best intentions, isn't it? It's like, you know, you have cancer charities who have cake baking coffee mornings, you know, bake a batch of brownies and turn up and fundraise. It's like, really? You know, could maybe be doing, I don't know, let's go and dig an allotment and have a walk in nature or something and raise money that way. But let's finish perhaps by looking at some of the conversations that you're having on the food program. You are hugely influential with that program and looking at things such as pesticides, ultra processed foods, you know, all things that frankly aren't food that ultimately end up in the bodies. Is there anything that we can do to start changing the system? Do you think from grassroots upwards, or do you think the ultra processed PR machine is just too powerful at this point?
I think it's very powerful. I think a very simple thing any government could do is you could introduce cooking classes. You could teach children to cook from the minute they get into age 5. You know, there's taste ed classes that ought to be in every single primary school where children learn to experience food, become familiar with food. You know, they learn about the feel, the sound, the food becomes part of their lives. It's well researched and it's tremendously successful. I've been to primary schools where classes of 5-year and 6-year-olds are cooking, and you know, in really some pretty tough areas of, you know, economically hard pressed areas, and children are naturally enthusiastic. They love cooking.
Yes,
you know, they love.
Yes,
and as I went to some high powered round table a few months ago. And somebody, you know, the food industry was there, supermarkets were there. And somebody said, well, you know, if a government said, okay, from, you know, you have a year to, you know, there's this money to build kitchens and so on. But if you had cooking in schools and, you know, the goal was by the time you are 11, you know, you ought to know how to make 8 things. Supermarkets would then have sections on ingredients for fulfilling this, because it would become a market. It's that we have 2 or 3 generations of people who food makes them nervous. They don't know what to do, and you're being thrown onto this. I mean, and lots, as you know, of ultra processed food has health claims all over it. You know, low in fat, vitamin enriched. And I think it was Michael Pollan, the American writer, who said, you know, I know Chris Van Tulleken said it more recently, you know, anything with a health claim on the packet is ultra processed. Avoid it.
Yes.
You know, we've moved so far away from using, you know, we think of food as being a problem instead of the answer. And we need to move to making it easier for food to being the answer. Teach people to cook. But that we can't ignore the fact that over the last, since austerity began, we have become gradually a more and more unequal society, where people can be doing 2 jobs a week, but they can't afford to buy food because it's the one, you know, your rent's fixed, your power's fixed, your, you know, certain costs are fixed. Food is something that you can spend, you can go, well, you know, I've only got, you know, £35 this week on food. And we have a tax structure that makes ultra-processed food cheap. Commodities are cheap. You know, we have a crazy system which is weighted in favor of companies making and selling ultra-processed food.
Okay, so Sheila, I'm going to end here by saying that we need to start a third career for you, moving from writing on feminism to food, and now I think politics clearly beckons. Minister of Food, please. Yes. Can we see this? Because I can think of nobody
wiser
and more experienced. Wouldn't that be so great?
Oh, my goodness me. Yeah.
Sheila, it's been such a pleasure. Seriously, thank you so much for taking the time to join me. I've so enjoyed this conversation. I do hope that we can continue it offline somehow. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Liz, for asking me.
Oh, Sheila, thank you so much for sharing so much of yourself and your research. I have to say, it's all fascinating, isn't it? And I hope that amongst some of the doom and gloom there about the food industry, there were some real hopeful nuggets there. And I will make sure that we post useful and helpful links and resources on the show notes to go alongside this. Well, I would love to know what you've taken from hearing Sheila talk today. Do join the conversation on Instagram at Lizelle Wellbeing. And I am there too. Personally, you'll find me at Lizelle Me. Better yet, send me an email or even a voice note. Yeah, you can do that now. And the address for that is podcast@lizellewellbeing.com. Now, would you rather be listening to this show without the ads? Well, do you know you can? Just subscribe to the Lizelle Wellbeing Show Plus on Apple Podcasts. For a very small monthly fee, you will get those ad-free episodes 24 hours before general release too. Yeah, a bit of a deal. Well, until the next time we chat, go well. Goodbye. The Lizelle Wellbeing Show is presented by me, Lizelle, and is produced by Anushka Tate for Fresh Air Production, with additional production support from Ellie Smith.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
ACAST powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.